Good afternoon, and welcome to the Thursday, May 5th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And members, we have members. And we also have four bills up, and we're going to take them in order, although we do have a few legislators that I think will be joining us shortly, so we may have to jump a little bit out of order. But let's start with the first bill, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2433. And Erin, could you tell us a little bit about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2433 extends deadline for filing nominating petition or declaration of nomination in event of untimely vacancy in partisan elective office, allows for extension of deadline for filing candidate portrait and statement in the voter's pamphlet. It comes to you with a 5901 vote from the House floor. There's a no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
And I see now that we have jumped in on our first bill, we have a couple of friends who have joined us on different bills, and in respect of their schedules, I think we will temporarily recess the hearing on House Bill 2433. And I don't know which of you is on a tighter schedule, but how about if we open a public hearing on House Bill 3074A? And Erin, could you briefly tell us about that as Representative Wisnett is joining us?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 34704A authorizes voting by electric mail for long-term absent electors if they include return identification envelope and a waiver of right to secret ballot, makes provisions operative January 1st, 2012, declares emergency is effective upon passage. It does come to you from the House floor with a 58-1-1 vote. In your packet, you will find a written testimony from Representative Hunt from the Military Department, and then also we received testimony just from Carla Hansen and Matt Flannery.
And I see that Representative Jean Wisnett has joined us, I think, for the first time this session. So welcome, Representative Wisnett, to the Senate Rules
Committee.
Thank
you very much, Madam Chair, and honorable committee members. It's an honor to be here and to be a co-sponsor of this. This is Representative Jean Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. And it's an honor to appear before this committee. I learned about this bill. Representative Hunt had introduced the bill, and I says, wait a minute, Dave, that's an issue I've been fighting for a long time. And he allowed me to be a co-chief sponsor with him, and he's sorry he cannot be here today. He had a groundbreaking, I think, in district that he's not able to, but as you said, as the administrator said, he did submit written testimony. This is a simple bill. The bill authorized voting by electronic mail for long-term absent electors. In 2009, I was the chief sponsor of House Bill 2511A, which allowed electors who serve in the armed forces and merchant marines to be eligible to cast ballots by fax machine, waiving their right to a secret ballot. In 2010, Senate Bill 998 extended those provisions to all long-term absentee voters, State Department people, or Americans that are still citizens working overseas. We discovered that there was a lack of availability of fax machines. So House Bill 3074 extends the provision to allow the use of electronic mail by scanning attachments, your ballot, which instead of faxing it, you're going to scan it and send it by email. This bill will help improve the distressing fact that many of our military members' ballots are not counted due to mail delays. I hope each of us believes that all citizens deserve the right to vote, and this bill will help assure that ballots of the men and women serving our nation are counted. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify and for hearing the bill, and I hope you'll move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you very much for bringing it to us. Do we have any questions for Representative Wisnett? I don't see any, so
thank you
very much, and we'll let you get back to your busy day.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Looks like we will come back to this bill because I think we have quite a few other people signed up to testify on it. And so let's recess the hearing on House Bill 3074 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2880. And I'll ask Representative Smith to come forward. And while he's doing so, Erin, just tell us a little bit about this bill.
Yes, House Bill 2880A creates 10-member National Voter Registration Act State Compliance Council consisting of representatives of the governor, county clerks, secretary of state, and 5 designated voter registration agencies, directs the council to assess federal guidelines, identify barriers, and ensure compliance with National Voter Registration Act 1993, directs the governor's office and secretary of state to staff the council, comes to you with a House floor vote of 60-0.
Thank you, Aaron, and welcome Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, this is a littler bill about a bigger thing. The National Voter Registration Act requires that agencies receiving federal funds provide voter registration to citizens and, quote, provide the same degree of assistance with regard to the completion of registration application forms as is provided by the office with regard to the completion of its own forms. Many states have fallen out of compliance with the NVRA. We're now aware, and states are getting sued. In fact, the day that this was up in rules, Senator Atkinson was carrying another bill. I don't know if you heard any of the testimony on this one. At that time, there had been 8 contested cases. We're now aware of 10, and probably growing. We don't think we're going to be the 11th, but we want to make sure we're not the 15th either. Missouri and Ohio were sued and lost. Ohio lost $450,000 just for attorney's fees. New Mexico and Indiana are now under court monitor agreements. Washington, New Jersey received notice of their noncompliance and have made plans to come into compliance. 2 other states, Georgia and Texas, have been given notice of impending lawsuits. And since we started working on this bill this session, Louisiana was sued and Rhode Island settled after being sued by the Department of Justice. It's particularly important for rural areas. And the amended bill is relatively simple. When we started working on this, to quote the Secretary of State, Jeff, I'm the one most likely to get sued, and I don't control the state agencies. And so the bill just tries to help us get in compliance by asking for a report on our compliance and then getting the agencies and Secretary of State in the same room to build a plan towards and continue to push along compliance. One of the reasons for the bill, and one of the reasons I really appreciate, Madam Chair, you offering the hearing, is that I think in order for us to do this, it's going to require effort from the legislature, from the Secretary of State, and from the executive branch agencies. There are some consensus amendments that you may already have that we hope will be considered. And we might need to do further work in future sessions. And so an ancillary benefit of this bill is just sort of put us on alert and be aware of what's going on. Last thing I want to say is, just about the last thing, is I want to applaud the Secretary of State, who I think is really gifted at this stuff, and her Deputy Barry Pack and their team for help keeping Oregon out of trouble and trying to make Oregon on the leading edge of secure, hassle-free voting. And all the folks who've helped out. It comes with a unanimous vote from that bastion of consensus, collaboration, and accomplishment, otherwise known as the House Rules Committee, and a 6-0 vote on the floor. And I'm happy to offer more if there are questions, or happy to offer less.
And thank you for your testimony. You mentioned these amendments, and we do have a copy of -2 amendments, which I think appeared pretty recently in our file. Are you prepared to talk about those, or is somebody else here?
Yeah, I can say a little bit. Really, it was we got advice that the time frame in the Angros version was too short, and so it just extends till January 2014 with an optional second report to the 2013 legislature. The way that it had been, it wouldn't necessarily be that the next full legislative session would learn what might needed to be learned. And the bill also got a name, and I think we shaved one member off the council, and I think that's about it. I think that's the extent of the amendments. Nothing earth-shaking, and it was really a matter of schedule as much as anything that meant hoping to do the amendments here rather than trying to delay House rules and do it there.
Okay, any questions for Representative Smith? Okay, I don't see any. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, and since we're now thinking about House Bill 2880, why don't we stick with it, and we'll call Kathy Eaton and Henry Kramer and Janice Thompson, if you'd like to come forward. And it looks like we already have Ms. Eaton's written testimony in our files, so you should have that in front of you or on your computer.
Good Thank you.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. And whichever of you would like to go first, please go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Senator Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathy Eaton, the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm speaking today in support of 2880-80. Compliance with the National Voter Registration Act, the NVRA, is essential to ensuring that eligible citizens can easily register to vote in Oregon. We consider this a voter access bill. We were one of the first states to enact what is known as the Motor Voter Measure, and we also need to make sure that we are complying with the Help America Vote Act to reach all types of citizens. HB 2880A is designed to assist designated agencies to carry out their mission in compliance with the NVRA and report to the Secretary of State their compliance or to provide a plan that will carry out that mission. The League supports this effort to give citizens access to voter registration information and forms and believe that the Compliance Council will help with that. This is a fairly simple means to increase citizen participation in the important act of voting. The League recommends that you move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Henry Kramer. I represent the Bus Project. We work to get young people and new people involved in democracy here in Oregon, and I'm appearing before you today in support of House Bill 2880 to assure Oregon's in compliance with federal registration law and to improve the security and efficiency of how we register citizens to vote in our state. This is a good little bill. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's cost-free. It identifies the problem and gives a solution, a fairly simple one. We know we need to be in compliance with the National Voter Registration Act across multiple state agencies, but we lack the clarity or structure to get there. And this bill brings the right people to the table. It provides sunlight and guidance for the pertinent agencies and puts us in a position to get in compliance without a fiscal, which is excellent. And we need to be in compliance as soon as possible. As Representative Smith said, other states have already been sued and gotten into other legal trouble for being out of compliance, and Oregon certainly can't afford that to happen here. At the same time, being in compliance will likely save us money in the long term by reducing inefficiencies in our voter registration system. You know, the National Voter Registration Act, originally at its core, was about making government more streamlined while making voter registration more secure and accurate. You see, when citizens apply for any number of basic services in this state or in other states, they give the government just about every bit of information they need to register to vote. But rather than integrating those services and streamlining government, we say to them, no, you have to go to a different part of government to get registered to vote. And this structural inefficiency made sense before digital records to some degree. But now it's just one of the countless ways that government could do well and save money by following the lead of the private sector and streamlining our services. This is the intention of the NVRA, and House Bill 2880 gets us there, helps get us there. You know, NVRA originally was a consensus bill in Congress. It was enacted with bipartisan majorities in both chambers, including our Republican U.S. senators at the time, Hatfield and Packwood. And in kind, House Bill 2880 is a consensus bill. It came out of House Rules Committee unanimously, came out of the House Representatives unanimously, and we urge your support of the bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I think we'll hear from the whole panel and then we'll open it up for questions. Please go ahead.
Janice Thompson, Common Cause, Oregon. Also in support of the bill, was pleased to also be supportive on the House side and be requested by Representative Smith's office to make some comments, you know, that contributed to your seeing the version you see now. And incidentally, the amendments do indeed sound okay. I think the situation here is that we have state agencies who want to comply. And one of the helpful things for me during the discussion on the House side was a recognition that what compliance means has not always been very clear. It's a topic that at the federal level, there's been essentially no history of directives to states, and that is changing. And so in this environment, I think this bill reflects the agencies want to comply, and this will provide the structure and to sort all that out, as well as, you know, particularly since there's this increasing clarity coming from the federal level. In that way, there was a reference by Representative Smith that there might be some next steps, and I think that could well be the case. I think that the original bill kind of was a second step, kind of jumped to, you know, audits and whatnot, and I think this is where we need to be starting with providing the structure for folks to really get themselves up to speed about what compliance means. And I particularly like the inclusion of the IT officers, because a lot of this is, as Henry mentioned, kind of taking a look at what is already there and how we can streamline and just make the whole process more efficient.
Okay. Thank you all three for your testimony. Are there any questions? Okay. I don't see any, so thank you for being here. And then we have two more people signed up, Steve Trout and Tom McClellan. If you'd both like to come forward, that would be great. Good afternoon, and welcome back.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director. We're here in support of House Bill 2880 and the establishment of this council. As some of the previous testimony mentioned, the U.S. Department of Justice has made this a high priority item in looking at compliance with the National Voter Registration Act, which came into law in 1993, and it wasn't until last year that the federal government put out any real guidance with respect to how states were to implement that. We were kind of left on our own. So some of the things that we've been doing, this new guidance has given us cause to go back and look and see if there's anything that we need to update in the way that we're administering the NVRA here in Oregon. So I think this council will help us to identify any issues that might leave us susceptible to any Department of Justice intervention, but also allow us to see the things that that we're doing well with the partnerships that we have. And be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, please go ahead.
I'm Jerry Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation is a voter registration agency under the NVRA. There was a reference earlier to the Motor Voter Program. That'd be us. We've been assisting with voter registration since the Act was passed in 1993. We offer voter registration to each person age 17 and above who applies for a driver's license, a permit, or an ID card in our offices. That's either an original, a renewal, or a replacement transaction for us. Applicants who respond affirmatively that they are interested in registering to vote, they receive a form. We print out a form right there in the office that is pre-printed with some information that they've already provided to us, their name, their date of birth, the driver's license number, their address, the current date. Most of the information they need to actually register to vote is provided right there in the office. They, of course, have to make their own choice on political affiliation and things like that, but we do most of the work for them. We receive the completed forms. We then deliver those to the appropriate local county elections office. But questions about voting processes and eligibility, we refer those to the county elections officials and the state elections officials. We also enable people to update their addresses for voter registration purposes, as well as what they're doing for us to update our addresses. It occurs in several ways. We accept address change forms in our field offices and also through the mail. People send quite a few of those actually to us. Fairly recently, though, we started sending that information to the local county elections offices and the state elections division to update addresses. That was not being done before. That was a problem as far as compliance goes with the NVRA, and I believe we have rectified that particular piece. There are still some questions about our online process. Today, you can update your address with DMV real-time through our website. It does take a separate click of the mouse to get to the Secretary of State's office website to update your address there. It's not a single step. And one interpretation of the federal law could be that we need to do that in a single step instead of two. So that is one area where we are looking very closely with the Secretary of State's office. We've looked to streamline processes to ensure compliance. We believe we are compliant, but the goalposts seem to be moving on us a little bit from the federal perspective, so we welcome the participation with a group like this. As an agency, we believe at the forefront of citizen contact with voter registration. We would anticipate participating on the council. We're not specifically called out as a member of the council. We are a voter registration agency, so we would hope we'd be part of that process. Did want to point out that we are a dedicated fund agency with the highway fund, and the Constitution restricts what we can do with our funds. We also have a fairly full plate of IT work that we must do over the next couple of years with our computer systems. Those are two limiting factors in how much we can actually do. But we do commit to doing as much as we can and working with business processes and streamlining of those over the next few years. So just in general, we are supportive of the bill. We do hope we can participate. There are some limitations, like I just pointed out, as far as how far we can go with spending of money and changes to computer systems. But we do look forward to working with the council and with the Secretary of State's office.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that generates a lot of traffic in representatives and senators' office, I'm sure, the relatively stringent requirements to demonstrate legal residency, proof of origin, birth. Could you just gloss those things for the record? And I'd like to hear from both folks, both about what you do to verify legal residence for a driver's license issuance and what you do to verify legal residency in Oregon to register for voting.
Can we start?
I'll be happy to start. Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, on every voter registration form, there is a box that must be checked to ask whether or not you are a citizen of the United States, as well as a box stating are you of legal age to be able to vote. If the box is not checked, the voter registration card is not accepted. But at this point, what we do is we take that check mark along with the voter's attestation when they sign that card that they are a citizen of the U.S. and eligible to vote under penalty of a Class C felony, and we take them at their word when they submit that.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, with DMV, with regard to our processes, since 2008, we have required proof of legal presence in the United States as part of our driver license and ID card issuance processes. That includes documented proof of an original birth certificate issued by the United States, a state within the United States, immigration documents, a U.S. passport, but not foreign birth certificates. So it is truly a legal presence standard that we have for our issuance. Evidence of residence or domicile, there are documents that we require from individuals that show that they've received mail at a particular address and they've certified that is their place of residence. So that's our process for both where do you live and are you in the country legally.
Madam Chair, just a comment. The standard for getting a driver's license is apparently much, much more rigorous than the standard for getting a voter registration card. And I think it's interesting that without the documentation required to get a driver's license, am I to understand that you'd not be able to register to vote through that process? In other words, if you couldn't get the driver's license documentation approved by the counter person, would you automatically not be able to register to vote in the voter registration process?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I'm not sure what DMV's counter process is as far as if they didn't have the documents there, and maybe Mr. McClellan can answer that. But
Madam Chair, my
yes,
question
Senator
I should.
Farioli.
Been more specific about directing. This is a question for the gentleman from the Department of Motor Vehicles. If an applicant comes to a counter without the proper documentation to get a driver's license, are they also not able to register to vote?
Madam Chair, Representative Ferraioli, there are a lot of different ways to register to vote, including in a DMV field office. If you are applying for a driver's license or an ID card, we've incorporated that process into our process. But separate from that, there are forms that people can just pick up, you know, as they walk in, fill out the form and submit that to the county elections office or leave it with us. So it's a depends kind of an answer to your question. If they're going through the process of getting a driver's license or an ID card with us, that's the point where we print out that form that's pre-printed with information. They finish those steps to then apply for voter registration. We are not approving those registration applications. We are sending them on to the officials who make those determinations of whether the person should be registered to vote.
Madam Chair, just it seems to me that it would be of tremendous benefit to the citizens of the state of Oregon if the process for getting a voter registration were identical to the process for getting a driver's license, since I would regard voting as a benefit of citizenship to be a far greater benefit than a driver's license. But maybe that is a topic that we can take up on another day, since that's the bill doesn't exactly deal with that issue. But it seems incongruous that it would be a much higher standard to get a driver's license than it is to be able to vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferraioli. And obviously there are a lot of other places that provide voter registration materials other than the Department of Motor Vehicles. So I wanted to ask you about the suggestion that you made, Mr. McClellan, about wanting to participate in this council. And it looks like the amendments to the bill, which I haven't really had a chance to look at until today, and I don't know if you have either, but call for there to be 5 slots on this council, but it references a statute. And I don't know, Steve, if that's ORS 247.208, if you're familiar with what designated voter registration agencies under that statute are. I don't know if that includes ODOT as one of those designated voter registration agencies or if those are all election-related entities. Do you know?
Madam Chair, it does include motor vehicles.
So then it sounds like what you're suggesting would be consistent with what the amendments are doing.
Madam Chair, I believe it would be possible. It's those members are named by the governor, so it'll be the governor's decision, I believe, even on the amendments, those 5 individuals.
And it sounds from your testimony that the agencies are already working in coordination mm-hmm. with each other in order to implement what's already in place. So I would assume that would be something that would continue under this new process. Okay, great. I don't see any other questions, so thank you both very much for your testimony. And, oh, yeah, Steve, why don't you stay put because we can come back and knock off another bill that you're interested in. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2880 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2433. And Aaron, why don't you tell us about this bill while we're shuffling our computer our papers, as the case may be.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2433 extends deadline for filing nominating petition or declaration nomination in event of untimely vacancy in partisan elective office, allows extension of deadline for filing candidate portrait and statement in the voter's pamphlet.
Okay, Steve, you're still here. And please reintroduce yourself and tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director. This bill is based on the passing of Mr. Westland right before the deadline to file paperwork for the election. So what this does is that in the untimely if there's a vacancy that's created right close to the filing deadline, it gives an extra 5 days for nominations to be filed. So if if normally the deadline would be the 70th day, if vacancy is 70th day before the election, if a vacancy is created any time between the 80th and the 70th day between the election, then an extra 5 days would be allowed in order to file nomination papers, and then they would have 2 more days to submit their voter's pamphlet statement and photos. So we're never going to be able to totally anticipate or plan for the untimely passing of individuals, but this at least will give us some flexibility during 10 days that we wouldn't have under the current law.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions about this bill? Okay, thank you very much for being here. And there are no more witnesses signed up to testify on House Bill 2433. Is there anyone here in the audience that is here to testify on House Bill 2433? Okay, seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2433, and I'll reopen the public hearing. Did we do this one partially? We did, yes. I'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3074A, and we'll go back and start at the top. We have Val Conley and Dave Jackson and Kathy Jackson. So if the three of you want to come forward, that would be great.
And just for the record, Madam Chair, Mr. Jackson did submit written testimony, and it is in your packet.
So whichever of you would like
Thank
to go
you.
First...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Conley. I am the Acting Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I am here today to support House Bill 3074A. Since 2001, more than 29,000 Oregonians have served in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. Deployments often require service members to be away from Oregon for long periods of time, during which Oregon holds primary, general, and special elections. Although Oregon currently provides an opportunity for Oregonians who are out of the state to vote using the absentee ballot, which must be delivered in person, by mail, or by fax, this method takes time and is often cumbersome to service members who are overseas, creating a barrier to voting. The fact is, many of our service members are deployed in places within Afghanistan and Iraq where mail and fax machines simply are not available. By implementing an electronic mail voting system, service members would be able to vote in Oregon elections from wherever they are in the world, including in forward operating bases in Afghanistan and Iraq. Electronic mail is a medium that service members are already comfortable navigating and can be done securely in the same fashion as many of us use it for banking or online purchases. The passage of House Bill 3074A would send a serious message to our service members that not only does their service to this country and state matter, but also that their vote in Oregon counts. The least we can do is create a system where those who ensure our right to vote have a vote themselves. Thank you for your consideration, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. I think we'll hear from the whole panel first.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Jackson. I'm a resident of Southwest Portland in Senator Jenny Burdick's district. It's nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
I come to oppose the 3074 as currently drafted. Before I get into my prepared testimony, I'd like to direct your attention to the submission of Dr. David A. Jefferson, who submitted some electronic testimony overnight last night. David Jefferson is I'm in awe of his he also submitted his resume. I've been on an email list with him for several years, and in reading his resume, I was like, oh my God, this guy has done everything. He's a PhD in computer science, and he's currently with the Lawrence Livermore Lab specializing in cybersecurity and national security simulations. So he issues a strong statement in opposition to this bill as drafted. His core principle is that email voting is worse than touchscreen voting if you want to have any kind of security. But I would recommend that you read his testimony in depth, because he outlines what he's basing this on and what the threats are that he anticipates seeing or has seen online, because that's what he does for a living. My own testimony is not necessarily as technical as Dr. Jefferson's, because I'm not a computer nerd. I'm more speaking from the standpoint of an informed citizen. And I'm concerned about the return, not the dispersal of blank ballots via email, but the return of voted ballots via email. This is where the risk lies. This puts the votes from our military service members deployed overseas at grave risk of hacking, phishing, computer viruses, as well as other nefarious schemes originating in countries that do not have the best interest of our country in mind, much less the security and integrity of our electoral process. I am not alone in my concerns. The U.S. Association for Computing Machinery's issue brief of last year contains the following warning. While returning voted ballots over the Internet could improve access and responsiveness for UOCAVA voters, Internet voting introduces dangerous risks that can allow elections to be undetectably altered by malicious attacks or buggy software. Without paper ballots, it is impossible to conduct a post-election audit or recount of the Internet votes. I strongly believe in paper ballots for all elections because they are voter verified and recountable. Email votes cannot be provably assumed to be voter verified, and by definition are not recountable in the same manner that regular mailed-in ballots are. The League of Women Voters of the United States has taken a position that ballots should be secure, accurate, recountable, and accessible. In other words, it's summarized as SARA. I've included their detailed statement in my prepared testimony. I will skip over it and summarize it thusly. In my opinion, HB 3074 does not follow the principles of SARA and allows basic tenets of verification, recountability, and auditability to be breached. However, let me give a little perspective on this issue. There have been numerous proposals for online voting out there for years. The DOD invested millions trying to design such a system. And in the end, they scrapped their system after spending millions of dollars and said they weren't going to try to sponsor one. So if they didn't think they could come up with a bulletproof system, I don't know if anybody else can. But there's still strong interest in using technology to make voting accessible to UOCAVA voters, especially military members putting their lives on the line in Iraq and Afghanistan. So Congress passed the MOVE Act in October 2009 to require states to increase access to voter registration and absentee ballots for UOCAVA voters, deployed military in particular. And let me make one thing very clear. Oregon is already in compliance with the MOVE Act and does not need to take any further action. Oregon already complies with the federally required timelines, online voter registration, and electronic transmission of blank ballots. Therefore, passage of HB 3074 is not required for compliance with the federal MOVE Act. Furthermore, only a few other states have rushed into the email return of voted ballots, most certainly because of concern about the security risks involved. According to the Overseas Voting Foundation, only 14 states permit email return of voted ballots without restrictions. I've included some maps detailing this with the reference of where to find the maps online from the Overseas Voting Foundation. 27 states, in other words, the majority, do not allow any email return of voted ballots. In the aftermath of the passage of the MOVE Act, there was at least one notable attempt to utilize technology, specifically online voting, to provide increased access for UOCAVA voters. The District of Columbia last fall set up an online set up an internet voting system last year and opening it up for testing in October 2010. Shortly after the test began, a team from University of Michigan headed by Professor J. Alex Halderman successfully penetrated the D.C. server and took control of it. The signal of the UM's team success was the Michigan Fight Song. The attack caused the University of Michigan Fight Song to be played for test voters when they completed the balloting process. I don't know if there are any Wolverines in this room who could demonstrate what the UM fight song, The Victor, sounds like, but it was not a welcome sound for the D.C. elections folk. The D.C. test was canceled, and the system was not rolled out as originally planned for the November 2010 election. The board's chief, D.C. election board's chief technology officer said the integrity of the system had been violated. Professor Halderman describes his test. Before opening the system to real voters, D.C. has been holding a test period in which they've invited the public to evaluate the system's security and usability. Within 36 hours of the system going live, our team had found and exploited a vulnerability that gave almost total control of the server software, including the ability to change votes, reveal voters' secret ballots, and reveal voters' secret ballots. In this post, and then he goes on to describe it. The specific vulnerability that we exploited was simple to fix, but it will be vastly more difficult to make the system secure. We found a number of other problems in the system, and everything we've seen suggests that the design is brittle. One small mistake can completely compromise its security. I described above how a small error in file extension handling left the system open to exploitation. If this particular problem had not existed, I'm confident we would have found another way to attack the system. Therefore, Halderman concludes, none of this will come as a surprise to internet security experts who are familiar with the many kinds of attacks that major websites suffer from on a daily basis. It may someday be possible to build a secure method for submitting ballots over the internet, but in the meantime, such systems should be presumed to be vulnerable based on the limitations of today's security technology.
And, Kathy, this background is really helpful. We do have your written testimony, though. I see the members have read it, and we do have quite a few other people to testify.
Okay, there's one other.
So if you could just summarize the rest.
I wanted to quote Dr. David Jefferson, and he's got a very excellent summary of comparing our vote-by-mail system with email voting, and I think that that's the conclusion of my testimony of David Jefferson's comparison of what we know here in Oregon versus what is being proposed, and it's not the same thing at all.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, and please go ahead. And likewise, we do have, I think, your written testimony. Two members were provided it, and thank you very much ahead of time. So it'd be great if you could not read it word for word, but just summarize.
His is a lot possible. Smart, shorter.
My name is David Jackson. I live at 10141 Southwest 55th Ave in Portland. I'm an Oregonian concerned about security and integrity of our election process, and I'm here to tell this committee to not pass House Bill 3074A. As currently drafted. One reason for this position about this bill is my recent personal experience with data breach. I was one of millions of Americans whose email was subject to data breach at a company I had never heard of before. I started receiving notice that my personal email might have been hacked. The company was Epsilon. I have since learned that dozens of large companies have been using Epsilon to manage their email lists, and that the email database was breached by unknown parties. As a notification from J.P. Morgan Chase put it, in corporate PR damage control mode, and well, I'll just basically summarize by saying that an unauthorized person outside Epsilon had access to the files and created some problems. Your email address was in our database and may have been one of those accessed. You can read the rest of it. We apologize if this caused you inconvenience. I received similar notices from Walgreens and several other companies regarding the Epsilon breach. So I have reason to be skeptical when a corporation tells me everything's okay. Plus, it is a common experience these days to find that assurances that form a large corporation are not to be trusted. Remember BP before the Deepwater Horizon blew. They told us that their rig was safe and we could trust them. We have since found out just how bogus those claims that everything was hunky-dory on the Deepwater drilling rigs, that they could drill for oil safely in the Gulf. The purpose of House Bill 3074A appears to be another authorization for a private company to not only take over another aspect of our elections, but to assure us without proof that their systems are foolproof and totally tested. We've been down this road before. A private corporation tells us that their proprietary systems work really, really, really well and have no security holes. My expectation is that some corporation is hoping to sell us the same kind of snake oil that they've peddled before. Any software that will manage this email ballot process has not been federally tested and certified by the Election Assistance Commission, and there is no way of knowing what the code is inside the black box and will process these ballots. I'm a strong believer in trust but verify, and there is no way to verify this email process. Therefore, there's no reason to trust it. I urge this committee to against passing the bill, House Bill 3074A, to the Senate floor for a vote unless the provisions for email return of voter ballots is removed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your concerns. And are there any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
And we have two more people to testify, so I'll call them both together, and that's Steve Trout and Michael Anderson.
Chair Rosenbaum, member of the committee, my name is Michael Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be extremely brief. You have my written testimony, or you will be getting my written testimony. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. We support House Bill 3074. We supported House Bill 2511 in 2009, which started the ability to return, or for long-term absent electors to return by fax. However, as one example, Multnomah County, the largest county in the state, they have about 2,700 long-term absent electors, 700 of those military, 2,000 of those other non-military overseas folks, and they frankly have just received very, very few faxes back. I believe only two back in the January 2010 special election and 85 in the 2010 general election. So from our perspective, this ability to return by email, since we can already send ballots by email, the ability to have them scanned and returned by email just makes a lot more sense, allows more people to participate in the process, and for that reason we support the bill. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director. We're also in support of House Bill 3074. It's really simple. It's really a simple bill. All we're talking about here is the transmission of ballots. We've had in law that our overseas and military voters can fax their ballots back, and we have a process there to maintain the security. We verify every single signature, and there are set processes that those ballots, when they come back in, have to go through. All this bill does is says that we have another transmission method, which is by email, and we will go through that same process. It will be emailed to the county. They will verify the signature to make sure that that is the voter that they say they are, make sure that it meets all of the other conditions, and if it does, then that ballot will be counted. So I want it to be clear that this is not internet voting. It's not email voting. All it is another method of transmission similar to through the mail, via fax machine, which we've had and had success with, and now this would add our overseas and military voters the opportunity to scan and email this back. It's been our findings that, as the county's representative said, most military overseas voters don't have access to a fax machine. It's technology that's quickly passing in the rearview mirror, but they do have access to emails. The ability to email is more secure to email back a ballot than it is to fax it. None of this is stored in any database. There's not any software. Again, it's not internet voting. I want to make it clear that this is just a transmission of a ballot via email, and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, and I think you were addressing some of the previous concerns in your testimony, but did you have any additional comments about the concern that this would make these ballots subject to tampering?
Madam Chair, thanks for the opportunity to address that. Again, I think there, previous testimony kind of mixed internet voting with what this bill really does, which again is only a transmission method. So the ballots aren't stored. There isn't any software that could be tampered with. Really, this is just a file going through the electronic waves from wherever the military voter is to a county clerk's office, and then they print that out. There's a paper trail with all of them. They're able to print it out. The process then would be they would go in and election officials would duplicate that ballot onto a machine-readable ballot, keeping the source document, obviously, to be able to go back in case there were any questions or any recounts, and then that ballot would run through the scanners the way that ballots cast through the mail here within the state are cast. So we've had success, have had no security breaches or issues with ballots being faxed back, and there's more security tied with the packaging of the file that would be emailed back, and so we're very confident that emailing the ballot back is at least as secure and more secure than faxing the ballot back, and something that we should have confidence in doing.
Okay. Yes, Senator Burdick.
And just as a kind of a double protection, you still have the same system in place to make sure that somebody doesn't vote twice.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, absolutely. So all of the processes that we have for a ballot, whether it comes in through the mail, whether it comes in by fax, and now if this bill goes forward, if a bill is returned by email, all goes through the same steps. It's logged in to make sure that we can only receive one ballot back per person. We would have that information. People would be able to go as a public record and know that that ballot had been returned. The voter that's overseas would be able to go on to our website and track their ballot to see that it had been received at the county for processing. So all of those protections that we have now for our regular mail ballots and the fax ballots would apply, and actually would be the same process that we go through if we're able to do this for email ballots.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you both very much for your testimony. I do not see anybody else signed up to testify. Is there anybody in the audience here on House Bill 3074 that didn't get a chance to sign up? Okay, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3074. And I think... okay. So we only have one bill remaining on our schedule. I think we're attempting to contact the sponsor, but there are a couple of other people signed up on the bill, so I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2912A. And Erin, could you briefly tell us about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2912A requires automatic vote recount at nonpartisan primary election when candidate is within 1/5, 1% of a majority vote, specifies that law doesn't apply to the offices of sheriff, county clerk, or county treasurer, or the nominating election is for the purpose of filling a vacancy. It comes to you from the House floor with a 59-10 vote. There is no revenue impact, but there is a fiscal impact statement, and it is with your materials. We also have received the written testimony from League of Women Voters.
Okay, thank you. And it looks like we do have, again, Steve Trout. We should have just asked you to stay put. And then Cappy Eaton, if you'd like to come forward and testify. Cappy, we do have your written testimony. So.
I'll try a different chair this time, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director. This bill, again, as with 2433, has it's because of history that we had at previous elections. This is from the state superintendent's contest back in the May primary, which was very close. And currently, state law says that an automatic recount is ordered if it's within 1/5 of 1% between candidate A and candidate B. In the superintendent's contest, that was the vote total was larger than that, but where it was close was that Ms. Castillo had just a few votes over the 50% plus one margin, which was necessary to avoid going on to a November election. If she fell below the 50% plus one threshold, then both the top two candidates would have moved forward to the general election in November. If she exceeded 50% plus one, as was the case, then there was no subsequent election in November, and she was declared the winner. So because of the closeness of that relative to the 50% plus one line, this bill is trying to provide for an automatic recount if it's within that same 1/5 of 1% threshold, not between candidate A and B, but between candidate A and the 50% plus one threshold. In a nutshell, that's what this does. One other note is that this doesn't happen very often, and I know that some history, there's been some look back in history to see how often this happens, and I think at the local level, it's they were only able to find one instance where this would have applied in the past 50 or 60 years.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Cappy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters, simply want to point out that we think this is a good bill. It specifically adds nonpartisan to the protection of close votes, and we think it's an important thing to put in the law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So, Steve, I'm just going to go back and I just ask you to explain this a little bit again. So, currently, in nonpartisan races, which can be resolved, obviously, if there are only two candidates in a primary, or even if there's more than two and one gets more than 50%, there are no automatic recount provisions in those primary elections?
So, Madam Chair, no, and thanks for letting me try to clarify here. If there was a difference of that 1/5 of 1% between the two candidates, there currently is an automatic recount.
Yeah.
In this case, it was greater than the 1/5 of 1% between the two candidates, but that really wasn't the issue. The issue was whether this was going to go forward for an election in November, because whether someone got 50% plus one or not, which is only going to happen in a primary and only in nonpartisan contests.
Okay, so, and just to explore this a little further, I see that in the fiscal analysis of the bill, it looks like they have an indeterminate fiscal, which I guess it would be indeterminate because it's hard to tell how many of these situations would come up. But then the example that they pick out is from a recount on a statewide measure, which this bill doesn't apply to statewide measures as far as I'm reading it. But I assume they just picked that as a statewide race where a number of ballots were cast that you could...
Madam Chair, it was it's difficult because we don't really have anything to compare it to. We do know that we had the recount in 2008 statewide, and so we're able to get we know that what the cost was there, and so it's fair to say that a statewide recount would cost similar to that this year. It's it will change with the number of ballots cast, and obviously with changes in the economy. I think the reason when we were submitting our information to LFO for the fiscal, it was just that it's too hard to predict when this is going to happen. It's one of those things in elections that comes up unexpectedly, and you haven't had time to put rules in place to be able to provide for that, and then you come in after that event, and it's hard to predict when it's going to happen next time. It may not happen for another 50 years. It may happen this next election, that's the reason for the indeterminate fiscal, I believe.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, I don't see any further questions, and I also don't see anybody else signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2912? Okay, seeing no one, and I guess we've been contacted. The sponsor isn't able to join us today. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2912, and I believe that completes our hearings for today. Mm-hmm. So with nothing further to come before us, member, we are adjourned. Thank you.